Magic Podcast. Join me on a journey to uncover the secret recipe to food and beverage industry success. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Food Magic Podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing you to my dear friend and fellow foodiepreneur, Jared Cannon, the CEO of Simply Jars. Hey, Jared, how are you?
What's up, Michelle?
So, let's dive right in. Jared, could you tell us a little bit about what your business looks like today, and then we're going to dial it back to ideation stage and how you got here?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, today we are operating in three states, several dozen locations with kind of the vending model that I think we proved concept on. We're actually entering kind of a whole new channel with kind of targeted retail customers as well. So,
So what is your product? Let's let our listeners know.
Yeah, so we, long ways ago in a land far, far away, thought that, the world needed a premium packaged salad that, looked good, had to taste great, that was portable, but also built around a sustainable idea that, single-use plastic is obnoxious, and the amount of plastic we as consumers consume on a yearly basis is nuts. I mean, one of the statistics is I think 1 million plastic water bottles a minute hit a landfill, and you start to compound that amongst food packaging, it's crazy. So, kind of fast forwarding here, it was really about building a packaged good product that had a return for reuse element. So, for every jar that you purchase, or Simply Good Jars product that you purchase, you can actually return the packaging back to us. We'll wash it, reuse it, put it back in the production circulation, and actually help to donate and feed someone in need locally in the communities that we're doing business. So here in Philadelphia, it's Philabundance. Up in Manhattan, we're working with City Harvest. And down in D.C., we have another entity. So, the premise is we really want to empower local customers and communities to better themselves through making better food choices.
I must ask, what's the best salad or jarred snack that you've come
up
with?
Man, it depends on. So what's funny is we find that a lot of our customers are, fans of one particular salad, and like they will defend it to the grave. I could tell you what my personal favorite is, but it could differ completely to, even internally on the team. And you go out and it's like team pesto, team salmon, team mushroom. So it does differ. I think, we found and kind of established the concept on kind of a packaged salad. We did add kind of a layered breakfast parfait and kind of an overnight oats product that's been doing phenomenal. I mean, it's the number one seller in the airport, for example.
Wow.
So, it definitely differs also, where these things are placed and,
that makes
and
sense.
How we're selling them. But yeah.
Just to wind it back a moment, Jared and I met years ago in West Philadelphia, born and raised, no, just kidding, in a shared kitchen space. And it's really fun to have watched how far your company has come.
Yeah.
I remember you hand layering the dressing.
I think it was maybe by myself or had one other person.
It was first by yourself and then you had one other person. And I remember watching that and being like, I should probably hire someone too.
Whoa, rewind. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
2.5 years later, 23 people, and, growing like crazy.
Amazing. And your own production line as well.
Yep. So about a month in, we've been commercialized. We can do about 2,000 units an hour.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, back when it was just me next to you, we were doing about 20 an hour.
That multiplier. I'm not going to do math right now, but... So, Jared, could you take us a little bit through your journey? I mean, you have some fantastic food experience before even really diving into your business, but something that really sets you apart from the crowd is that you've been ideating and creating this concept on paper, manifesting it in a better sense of the word, for a long time. So can you talk about that process? Because I think a lot of people have ideas and then they get nervous on where to start, and really, you can start in many different ways.
Yeah. I mean, from idea to implementation to launch was about 5 years.
Wow.
And, you know, working professionally, going through my MBA, and just, you know, for me, it was just about living in a moment and in time and space where, you know, you start to look around you and understand that there's, you know, a service that I myself would buy right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so for me, it was like, you know, you always have the aha moment. But, you know, I think what took me so long to realize that it was something I was willing to take a risk on was that, you know, as you kind of move through and tell people about your idea, your concept, you know, even get people to taste stuff. I mean, the good thing about food is you can go to the grocery store and spend $5 and you can make this salad and you can give it to somebody for free and be like, here's a free salad.
Try it. Yeah.
Tell me what you think.
Yeah. The R&D process looks different in tech than it does here.
Yeah, so. There was a lot of that. But, you know, there was also the element of like, how I'm living paycheck to paycheck. How would I ever start a business? Right? So, you know, everything from, you know, the fear of like, how am I going to survive, pay back these student loans to, you know, is my idea even worth something? Would anybody even buy this? I think for me, it was more about kind of just getting out there and kind of throwing it to the wolves and letting people kind of tell me what they would like, what they would not go for. And, you know, the idea of a salad in a jar was, you know, constantly challenged.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, you know, some of the good ideas are, you know, things people can't wrap their head around, or else somebody else will be doing it. So
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So what did you, what was your past food experience and how did that prepare you for what you're doing now?
So when I was old enough to stand on a stool, I was cooking in the kitchen at home from, I don't know, 3 years old.
Wow.
Stuffing turkeys. My grandmother would always come over. We would host, you know, different holidays with the family, and, you know, we would cook in the kitchen together. And, you know, at one point I realized, and I was like 15, you know, who has a realization of like what they want to do at 15 years old? But I guess I did. So
I want to chime in here. This is your food magic moment.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Food magic moment. Yeah. You know, the realization that I really just truly enjoyed being in the kitchen, creating food, creating flavors, presenting it to people, and then creating, you know, lasting memories. So I was like, all right, I'm going to do this. And it was right around the time Emeril, you know, was on TV and Mario Batali, and that was probably it. Like, I don't even think the Food Network existed. And, you know, the concept that maybe, just maybe, you could do something, you know, make something of yourself by being a professional cook. So pursued that, went to the Culinary Institute of America. And then, you know, an 18-year journey in the industry, you know, everything from hotels, fine dining, fast casual, you know, everything in between,
mm-hmm.
All the way down to Miami, up through the Carolinas and back to Philly.
Wow. Big road trip.
Yeah. No, it was East Coast tour.
Yes.
Yeah, of food.
Of taste bud. Taste bud tour.
Yeah.
What do you think helped shape the vision of what you're building now?
So, I mean, what we're truly trying to do is really reimagine food package for the on-the-go lifestyle and, you know, access to healthy food that tastes good. You know, at the end of the day, if flavor's king. If it doesn't taste good, nobody's going to come back for it. Nobody's going to tell their friend. You know, you can go to a rest stop or, you know, a convenience store and grab, you know, something under $5. And your expectations are you're not really going to enjoy this, but at least you're not going to be hungry anymore. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to, you know, flip out because you're hangry or whatever. Right. And you just kind of fill the void, you move on. But, you know, for us, you know, especially being a chef, right, like really, you know, creating products that are craveably delicious, that are things you know, sit on the couch late at night and you're like, I can't wait to have that again. And so that's kind of what we strive for. And you know, I think the motivation is if we can really connect flavor, craveability, access, and sustainability to the world of food, I mean, what a massive opportunity. So we're very early, you know, we're by no means successful. We could fail next month.
You know what? Everyone is hardest on themselves.
But, you know, we're charging forward with the best intention of mind and see what happens.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the customer experience? Because I've had the vending machine experience, and it's very, very unique. It's a different approach to how your food is presented, and sometimes as a food operator, you don't always have control over the way that your product is presented, and I know that you're doing everything you can to have some control over that.
Yeah, so, you know, the one of the primary methods that we retail our products is through smart RFID-enabled vending machines that we place in places where people are kind of held captive and can't really get away or don't have access to food, let alone healthy food.
Like a work campus.
Work or like hospital sometimes, right, is a good example. Airport. You know, places where you kind of intuitively think, like, I wish I could have something healthy. There's nothing here. I'm going to get a cookie or two candy bars or a burger.
I resent that. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, it happens all the time. But, you know, the uniqueness of that channel was kind of discovered, you know, years back, again, kind of, you know, rewind that five-year ideation phase. A lot of research into the market and the strategy showed that, you know, if you were to monetize convenience, you would take number of available locations, multiply it by number of units sold per location, and you kind of have some sort of monetized value of convenience. So if you do that, Subway is the most convenient restaurant in the U.S., followed by McDonald's, followed by vending machines.
Interesting.
And if you think about what's typically in a vending machine, it's a familiar, you know, way of retailing products, but it's unhealthy. I mean, you'll see healthy vending, and it's like baked chips and like diet soda. And it's like, it's kind of not really healthy. So, you know, to me, that was a massive opportunity. So to take something familiar, you know, really furnish a fully satisfying, healthy meal, under 600 calories, tasted good, you know, all of our, you know, things. But, and by doing that, we have visibility into everything that's stocked in the entire fleet in every state, city that we have product.
You can tell what's moving, what's
because
selling.
Of that RFID visibility. So every product is uniquely smart tagged, if you will. And, you know, from anywhere in the world, we can dial into that and see what's moving, what's not. We can adjust, you know, what we're sending to different locations based on the profile of, you know, a location preferring vegetarian or chicken or fish or breakfast or, and really kind of build the curation of products to meet what's working.
Wow.
To limit waste and, you know, drive sales and, you know, all the fun stuff.
Definitely. So you went from a team of 1/2 to 23. What did that growth experience look like for you, and what types of qualities were you looking for in terms of your team members?
1,000% day by day. I mean, if you rewound, put me back in the same place, you know, Groundhog Day scenario, there's no way, you know, the same outcome would occur. And I tell myself that all the time. You know, it's, I would say half of our employees we met randomly out and about doing something, former customers, just like, you know, whatever. And I've always taken the approach when looking at, you know, how we build our team to, you know, not trying to make somebody fit into a box, but, you know, taking someone's skill set, their strengths, their weaknesses, all of the, you know, everything that comes with somebody, and really challenging them, like, write your own job description. Tell me what your dream job is. Send it to me, and I'll let you know if there's a match.
Wow.
Right? So a completely different approach. It's,
it is.
It's not.
Very
I've
unique.
Never posted a job description. I don't. Or maybe I. Maybe we did a couple, but very rarely have I ever, you know, posted a job description for a core member of the team. Instead, I've, you know, kind of really had a big picture vision in terms of how we would structure the organization. You know, I've run companies with thousands of individuals and, you know, manage hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So, like, I understand how an organization works and molds and fits and where the culture elements suck and where they can thrive. And but that was an approach that we took early on that has continued to this day, and I don't see it changing because it's been phenomenal.
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
What are you looking for next? You're growing the team a bit more, right?
Always growing, yeah. I mean, we're always looking to, you know, understand what's next, what's on the horizon, you know, understanding that, again, it's less about filling a role and just getting the right person on board to, you know, it's like adding jet fuel to a fire, right? Like if, and it's similar to like taking on investment. It's like, you know, if you're not ready, you're just going to put it out.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're ready, you know, you add at the right time or at, you know, what, with the right element, you know, you can, you know, have some, you know, pretty rapid results.
Yeah. I think this must have something to do with just who you are as an individual and overall the experiences that also make up who you are. But how do you, you do a very good job of staying in the, in your lane, which means that you're the owner, you steer the ship, you're the visionary. So how do you maintain that with the small, menial, day-to-day tasks that kind of take you away from that too? It's like balancing the short-term versus the long-term goals.
So me personally, I mean, I kind of structure my world, if you will, as a, you know, never start a new task until the prior one's finished. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I won't take a phone call if I'm in the middle of sending an email or, you know, talking, you know, out something with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And the same's true in kind of any situation, you know, so that nothing's left unfinished, so that I can know that whatever I'm focused on is going to see its way down and through to completion, or at least a point of understanding that, you know, time and attention is no longer needed here, and then moving on, but doing that in rapid succession.
Yeah.
You know, like hundreds a day. And, you know, sometimes it's menial tasks, and sometimes it's bigger, larger picture things, and sometimes it's time sensitive and urgent, and oh my God, the place is burning down. And, but, you know, it's, you prioritize based on what's in front of you, and just, you know, get it done one at a time. You know, for me, it's like I would rather have two open items, both at, you know, 80% than have 10 at 20%,
because
I'm going to drop the ball.
Right. You don't want to spread yourself too thin.
I'm not perfect. You know, I think I can multitask. And, you know, in the kitchen, you know, you're kind of a multitasker by like working three pans and boiling this, and you're making a sauce and a reduction over here, and something's in the oven. And but at the end of the day, it's like nobody's great at that. Like, just, you know, limit your world, mm-hmm. and master what's in front of you.
Yeah.
One at a time.
What has been one of the biggest challenges in putting together your business, and how did you climb that mountain?
I mean, I always look at challenge as opportunity and exciting and motivating. So, like, for me, you know, when there's something to be done, I am the most receptive, the most on ball, the most, you know, in attack mode. When things are, you know, there's really nothing to do, that's when I get like anxious and I'm like, what's going on here? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, it's, you know, it's, I take and kind of frame, you know, needs and struggles as opportunities to, problem solve or whatever the case is. Right. Like, you know, when I was pitching for investment early on, you know, nobody says no ever to, you know, the first 50, maybe, I don't know.
They don't say yes either. They just don't say anything.
Right. But, you know, for me, it was like, my mindset was just like, you know, one day, you know, I envision in my head a moment where, you know, you're like, man, I passed up on that. You know, and that to me is more motivating than being discouraged in the moment that somebody doesn't believe in my idea or my concept or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's just frame of mind. And, you know, like I said, one task at a time. You know, don't get discouraged by shit going wrong, because shit goes wrong all the time.
Sure.
And that's kind of been my ethos, if you will.
Can we dive a few steps deeper into the investment side?
Because yeah, sure.
That's a piece that, you know, obviously food is very different than tech. The investment cycle is different. The process, I mean, it has its similarities, but what are your recommendations? You've done a really great job of this piece of your business, and
what advice
do you give?
It's a long road, right? It's, I mean, I didn't even know what the difference between a convertible note, a safe round, common versus preferred share was, any of that when I started this.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of learn as you go, but you know, I think, for me, especially being in food, which is very unique, very niche, you know, a lot of people think they know a lot about food, but, you know, in the reality, it, you know, unless you've been there, breathed it, done it, you know, have burns up your arms and cuts on your hands, you know, you can't really claim it. So, you know, I think after all said and done, you know, today my biggest recommendation would be, you know, you want people on your team, especially in the investment side, that understand what you're doing, that, you know, can add value, and that aren't just a source of, you know, check or money to survive. Right. And it took me a while. Yeah, that's in some way strategic, but more so, maybe if they can't even add any intangible value, if they at least they understand what you're doing, how you're going about it, and you know, aren't going to ask, you know, 30 questions that you hear all the time from people that just don't get it. So, and it's just distracting. So the more you can be less distracted, the better. So all said and done, I would say, you know, you really want, you want to be okay with walking away from a conversation, understanding that there might not be a match. But the biggest piece of advice I always give, you know, entrepreneurs or people in the fundraising mindset is that even if it's a no for, will you invest in my company at these terms or at this amount or whatever, you know, leveraging the network of every individual you come across is immensely valuable. So, you know, even if you can't get an investment, if you can get an intro, sometimes it's better than getting an investment, right? Especially if it's from the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always have kind of that backup mindset where, you know, you're going into something, whether you get an investment or not, you know, whatever. But if you can get an intro to somebody else who can help you in something, some facet of what you're doing, you know, it's going to pay itself tenfold.
Yeah, I always say you never know who holds the key to the next door you need to walk through. Could be the most random person.
Everybody does in some capacity. They just don't know it.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of messengers, right? We're not going to – it took me a long time to learn this too, but if someone is not a fit culturally or vision-wise, it doesn't make sense to work with them.
Nope, absolutely.
So what do you think is next for Simply Good Jars, or what's next for you?
We got all kinds of stuff brewing, or shaking, I should say.
Yes.
So we are, like I said, we're on the cusp of some pretty substantial growth. We're opening up what we call preferred resellers, or approved resellers. So, you know, the idea that, you know, we can separate the jar from the smart vending concept a little bit, and we can really start to go to market in a really big way. Through sitting on the shelves of some really strategic partners we already have on board, and that we continue to, you know, kind of, you know, work through different programs that we think are a great fit for our products, you know, all while ensuring that we maintain the vision and the capability for the return for reuse program and everything that, you know, the business was built on. So there's a lot going on, lots of problems to solve, you know.
Yeah.
But
the eco-friendly trend, I really think it's here to stay, but we're seeing it in the space of events, in the space of food, and the space of the way that people are living and just doing things in general. So that's amazing. So your partners are also on board with that vision.
Yeah, and I think what we do is we bring a pretty turnkey solution into the environment that, you know, our infrastructure is already built to support this at scale. So, you know, the reality of not having to create a sustainability initiative plan, pitch it to the internal teams, you know, create a breakout team to implement. In 3 years, you might have an idea of what, you know, you can do in a large organization. Or you can just say, why don't we stock Simply Good Jars and we'll take care of it. So, so that's pretty exciting.
What does the sales cycle look like with a larger partner? I mean, does it take a certain amount of time? Have you been able to put some analytics around the process?
Yeah, so I mean, we take orders, get them out, you know, 2 days later, within 24 hours to their facilities, and they take it from there.
No, I mean, like, actually starting a conversation with a company to the launch of
being
partners.
Yeah, relationships, you know, usually take time to build. You know, we call, you know, our customers in the more traditional term partners, because, you know, we're dually motivated by the same implementation of the program. So, you know, we're not just out to sell products to people that want to be cool or niche, or, you know, have a product that differentiates, you know, their competitor on the shelf. It's more about, you know, aligning you know, the goals of our organization, the goals of their organization, finding ways where we can duly add value, and then charging forward together with, you know, equal risk.
Mm-hmm. And how do you manage suppliers? I mean, as you grow, you're going to need more greens, more salmon.
But we're starting to kind of get into the world of, you know, dedicated grow fields and houses and things like that.
Wow.
And we're keeping local. So, like, you know, our facility that we have, you know, in this region, you know, we're getting the greens from literally 1.6 miles down the road.
Wow.
You know, what's the blessing there is that, you know, when you commercialize a product, you need to have certain traceability, food safety things in place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually really hard to find suppliers that have these programs in place in their facilities that even qualify to drop off product at our facility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've turned away so many vendors just based on their inability to pass a certain bar that we set as a food safety standard. So the blessing is that there just happens to be a farm 1.6 miles away from the facility that, you know, meets all the criteria. And it's
wow.
Like, well, this is great.
Match
you know?
Made in
let's,
heaven.
Let's grow this thing. And we found similar suppliers and vendors and growers in different regions,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the Finger Lakes region, out in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the Southwest and the West Coast is where a lot of produce and vegetables are going. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we may or may not be going out there soon. So, you know, we are, you know, constantly trying to stay ahead of, you know, the supply relationships, but really keeping in mind that, you know, this isn't a small, you know, one-off, quaint family-run farm that
right.
we're targeting. We're targeting, you know, substantial operations. So
as the head of your ship, what keeps you grounded? How do you? I don't even like to use the word work-life balance, work-life integration. What allows you to still be sane and do what you do and manage all that you manage?
I mean, 80% of it's the team that we have. You know, if you know, we didn't have the right people on the ship, I think that, you know, I would have a lot of sleepless nights. The good news is I typically fall asleep relatively easy, and I sleep 7 hours-ish, you know. But granted, I'm going down at like 8:30. I'm getting up at like 4:30, but, you know, that's just the way it's wound. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, we have a great team that can, you know, really take the ball, run with it, knows how to prioritize and can get the job done and understands where how priorities flex and mold. And, you know, more than half of them have been here, you know, almost 2 years. So, you know,
wow.
over, you know, 70% of the time the business has been here. So
that's pretty amazing.
It's pretty cool.
Do you have any mentors or any sources of inspiration that you really look to that have guided you through your experience?
Yeah, and I think, you know, naturally I'm a problem solver, so I like to take a lot of things, process them, and create solutions, implement, test, pivot, iterate, you know, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But you always need mentors. You always need people that have been there, done that, to kind of, you know, throw up the flag and be like, I see where you're going. I was there myself, and it's not going to turn out good, so you might want to rethink this. And in a lot of cases, it's, you know, making introductions to people that can help solve a particular problem or need or fill a void or, you know, simply sit around a table 4 times a year and help really guide the direction and strategy of the company. So, you know, I've always taken the approach that, you know, if I'm not the dumbest person in the room, then, you know, I need to find someone smarter.
Yeah, you need to find a new room.
Yeah, need to find a new room. Right.
Definitely. When you're at your best, are there some rituals or habits that you feel like you've built over time?
Nope, not at all. I'm sure you were expecting a yes.
I was expecting a yes, but I always love to ask that question because it really varies person to person.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends on what you're implementing. I recently started implementing a morning routine. It's been awesome for my energy, but
yeah,
to each their own.
I would love to have a routine, and I strive to have a routine, but the reality is I tell everybody, you know, that I come across, you know, every day's a Monday. And, you know, it's that Monday vibe, that Monday feel. You know, you're a little bit behind, you don't really know what's going on, you gotta kind of, you know, bring it into focus. And that's just kind of how I live my day to day. And it's not stressful. It's, you know, I don't have anxiety. I'm not pulling out my hair. I'm not losing sleep. But, you know, it's all mindset.
You spend a lot of time putting this on paper before you put it out in the world. What are benefits of that method versus cons of that method?
So I never created a full-fledged business plan that you would submit, you know, to a business plan competition, if you will. But I did iterate a lot. So for me, writing things down and visualizing it is key to help me understand and rework, if you will. It's also, you know, good to share with people. So I took the approach of, you know, really sharing the concept, approach, idea, pivots, iterations with as many people as I could. And I paid attention really closely to how they would react to what I said or what I showed them. And for me, the goal was to better understand how the product was presented as an idea or as a physical thing to someone versus, you know, what they were going to tell me. It was more kind of observational than it was, you know, any other type of motivation. But, you know, I never wanted to flesh out and put so much time into like one way of doing something, because then I feel like I wouldn't, I would be more unlikely to change it. So
you didn't want to get too attached.
Didn't want to get too attached to it. But you know, getting it down, visualizing it, and then letting it change over time helped a lot.
Planning, but leaving room for flexibility.
Yeah. Because the reality is, nobody's ever going to buy the first version of the first idea
had,
you know, and if you're not paying attention and if you're not willing to, you know, fail fast, throw in the towel and change, you know, it's, I think that's how businesses ultimately fail, is just, you know, not paying attention, being too egocentric, or not, you know, really just being in tune to what the customer's saying and responding to them.
What was that transitional moment from paper to starting to execute? What went through your head, or what made that happen?
It was like, so, you know, I was making six figures. I wanted to start the business, but I didn't know how I would quit a paycheck to paycheck job. I got a $1,000 loan and told myself, if I blow it, I tried. I'll go back to, you know, working for someone else. But if not, you know, great. And, you know, to this day.
If not.
Yeah. Haven't looked back since.
Day, if not,
yeah.
That's awesome.
If not to this day. But, yeah, it's just been, you know, I have no idea how we did what we did from day one to now. And like I said, if we went back and if it was a Groundhog Day scenario and we went back, you know, to November of 2017 and said, you know, reset, repeat, I don't know if we would have made it. Maybe we would have. Maybe it would have been different. Who knows? But it was so day by day, and it was so minute by minute, introduction by introduction, being at the right place at the right time, and really fighting to create as many scenarios as possible to just get that lucky break, that, you know, it's unrepeatable. So,
how do you measure success in what you're building?
I don't know. I mean, I get a lot of fulfillment in seeing the way that customers interact with the product when they're seeing it and learning about it for the first time. And, you know, it's like, why hasn't anybody thought of this? You know, it's food that tastes great first, and nobody expects it to taste good for some reason.
Because it looks healthy. No.
I guess. I don't know. But
it looks very green, and it is delicious.
And then it's like, okay, well, this is really good, and then, you know, how do I get it? And then, you know, then what do I do with it? And then, oh, my God, like, I don't have to feel guilty when I'm done. I can, like, actually feel, like, good that I'm giving back, because you're going to help feed a homeless person when I return this jar to you. Like, holy moly.
Amazing.
So that, yeah, that, you know, gives a lot of, you know, fulfillment, I would say. You know, seeing that the model that finally came together in some form factor is working. And, you know, we got our first 2 years of business, 93% of the jars came back.
Wow.
And even today, you know, with our extension into new markets in the airport, you know, places where you think, you know, we would plummet, we're 77%, which is, you know, lower. But,
but some
still...
people are taking it on the plane with them. It's different.
Yeah, but people are mailing them to us.
Wow.
They're bringing them back to where they bought them in the airport. I mean, it's pretty phenomenal people do with these jars. I've run into people and it's like, I have a jar for you. I have not seen them in, you know, a year.
Wow.
And for whatever reason, they were compelled to keep the jar, not throw it away, and found a way to get it back to me.
I have to be honest, from a customer standpoint, I reused it at home and
great.
Just made salads.
And that's great. And we love, I mean, reuse it, you know, gift it,
right.
Do whatever you want. We don't care. You know, we just want to really drive this idea of, you know, things can be reused. You know,
it's
not single use.
Is there a name for this? Because I feel like this is going to be
circular economy, or, you know, return for reuse is kind of what the way that we preach it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
maybe that's something you guys can coin.
Well, we play with the idea of Beyond Zero Waste very, very early on,
mm-hmm.
with the idea that, you know, not only are we zero waste, but we actually go beyond that and, you know, help to feed someone in need. You know, good deed for good deed equals good deed.
I really love that. I feel like you should play with that a bit more.
Yeah, we played with it.
Yeah. That's a really cool direction to take it.
It's hard enough to build a brand.
I know.
But
that does become part of the,
of course,
the customer excitement. And I think that the economy that we're in is really moving towards zero waste. And that's something we struggle with from a food perspective all the time.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting elements, you know, financially or more operationally on our business model is that, you know, our packaging are assets. They're not cost of goods.
Wow.
Right? Because they're retained. They depreciate over time. We get enough uses out of a single product to have it last over a year.
So how many times do you think you could fill it until it's not usable?
So we average about 88 uses per container, and we've never, ever, in any day that this business has been established, thrown away or even had to recycle a jar. They just don't come back. So people are out there using them, setting them around. They're sitting on a shelf waiting to bump into me on the street somewhere. You know, something.
They're holding pencils, whatever.
Yeah, right. You know, we've seen, we were in Reading Terminal for a couple months and, you know, walked through Reading Terminal the other day and saw a Simply Good jar filled with salt.
I love
at a
that.
Station. Yeah, it's like.
And your brand is sitting right there.
Yeah.
That's genius.
Yeah, right. And I thought so too.
No big deal.
Yeah.
Jared, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
Hit us up, simplygoodjars.com, at simplygoodjars. You can find me on Twitter, the real Jared Can. you know, just follow us, follow us along for the ride. We're excited, and you know, we wanna, you know, really create this movement around, you know, making better choices, you know, for us all, but then also, you know, for our community. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks
so much.
I want to add one little PS.
Sure.
When I experienced it for the first time, one of the things that I really loved about the jarred salad was that you shake it,
mm-hmm.
and you actually get the flavor of the dressing throughout the entire salad. How many times do you go out and buy a salad and, like, the dressing is on one side or it's soggy or it's on the top? Like, it just doesn't make sense. And I really, really love the experience from the customer standpoint.
Yeah. The harder you shake, the better it tastes.
We're going to end on that note. Thank you very much. Tune in next week. Looks like we're all out of time for today. Thanks so much for tuning in to discover the secret recipe to food and beverage industry success. Make sure to tune into next week's episode. And in the meantime, spread the love. Check us out on Instagram or our website, Food Magic Podcast. Mwah!